If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
The future. What's it really like?
My children lost their beloved mother to influenza.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Cool.
This is the Extra Hot Rate Podcast, episode 293 for the week of March 9th, 2020. I am once-in-a-century explosive event David T. Cole, and I'm here with turkey trotter Sarah D. Bunting.
23 Skadont.
Ragtime gal Tara Ariano.
Hello, my babies.
And subterranean apothecary juke joint Mark Lozanti.
Cabbage.
Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Joining us is our dear old friend Mark Lozanti. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Mark.
Mark Lozanti.
Hi, guys.
Yay! We are here to talk about Amazing Stories, the newest release from Apple TV Plus, which some of us who are of a certain vintage may know is the revival or remake of the, I believe, two-season NBC show from the mid-80s, which was then and is now an anthology show, sort of a light-sided Twilight Zone, vaguely sci-fi-tinged situation. However, a little background before we get into it. We've only been given one episode to screen, the same as all of you. It dropped last Friday with an episode titled The Cellar, which we will talk about. But it had an extremely weird PR rollout. Basically, we got one episode. This is an anthology show.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, we got one episode, the same one that dropped for everybody else. On IMDb, when we were planning this episode amongst ourselves, The Cellar was episode 4. Now it's episode 1, I guess. And originally, IMDb said that 5 episodes were going to drop on the premiere date. That did not occur. The embargo for the press did not lift until it was available to the public. So no reviews were supposed to come out, basically, for anyone. So, Mark, you are a seasoned observer of showbiz bullshit. How much would you say this situation stinks? Let's start there.
It doesn't smell great. I mean, it was a show that took a long time to get out the door, right? Mm-hmm. Because originally, when they announced it, it was supposed to be run by Brian Fuller, who did Hannibal and American Gods, more of like a temperamental visionary type of guy.
Mm-hmm.
He left it after a certain point because I believe he had more of like a quirkier and darker vision for it.
Sure.
Didn't feel Apple TV premium / Spielbergian enough, I guess. So then they replaced him with the new showrunners who came from Once Upon a Time. And before that, they were Lost writers, I believe. That sounds right to everybody.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, when you read about this kind of stuff, this kind of semi minor, but maybe not that minor, behind the scenes drama, you know, with the Apple TV Plus launch problems. One episode to the press at the beginning, and then I guess they decided strategy is going to be weekly drops.
Right.
That's not that weird at this point. Everyone's tinkering with that all the time now.
Yeah.
But, you know, you might want to give the press more than one to make informed opinions of us. An anthology show is only as good as each episode. You know, every episode's its own thing. You're going to give people a chance to try to draw a lot of conclusions from just one episode that may or may not be representative of the whole.
but here we go.
Right.
With that being said.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's impossible not to contrast this with the rollout for a show that we talked about in January, Little America, which the whole season dropped at once. The whole season was available to critics ahead of time. It certainly seems like there's a difference between a show that Apple TV Plus is really proud of and one that it may want to bury, right?
Yeah, you get that. There's a shoveling feeling a little bit around it when it does that.
So, Sarah, you felt that this was a bad one to start with. Are you talk about that and then the possibility that like this was their judgment of the best one to start with, possibly?
It feels like they're trying to sneak this one past us. Here's the thing. What mm-hmm. we were just talking about the behind the scenes stuff and all the like shifting sands of what's going on IMDb, et cetera, and so on, is like the most interesting thing about the show. I would rather watch them like find a bunch of old shit in this farmhouse than deal with the time travel story. If we're going to make Jazz the centerpiece, like, are we being trolled? Possibly. If we're going to make Jazz and a flu the centerpiece of this premiere episode, don't have a gazillion anachronisms. That like the timelines didn't work, but it was also like, this is an anthology series and you have to make me care about these people a lot faster or have a more interesting premise. It had neither. I'm not angry at it, but it was like, this was 53 or 54 minutes that felt much longer. I don't understand why you lead with this. Like, it's not the shittiest thing I've ever seen, but that at least would have been compelling. That I would have been like, oh my God, what a miscarriage of television. Like, it just was this nothing burger, or as I guess they used to call it in 1919, a nothing hamburger sandwich.
A nothing steamed ham?
Yeah. Thank you. There it is. I mean, was anyone else just like aggressive, like capital yeah. About this? Because
yeah, the original series had two modes. It had feel good slight twist story and it had more of the fantastical episode. So for example, there was an episode in the original where Mark Hamill plays this guy that is just like a collector of all this stuff and everybody makes fun of him and blah blah blah, and eventually like just becomes this loser the longer he lives until the end of the episode where somebody goes through all his shit. And it's like, oh, you got the Action Comics number one here. You got da 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 da. So a guy's like got 10 years to live and he's a gazillionaire. That's like one episode, right? That's more like what they're doing here. You know, it's a love story, but it's a underdog story, but. And then there was ones like the Kevin Costner episode where he plays a bottom belly turret gunner on a World War II bomber. He's also like a doodler, a cartoon doodler and caricaturist. And the landing gear on his plane sticks and they have to land. So he's going to get squished because he can't get out of the bubble. And at the very end of the episode, he draws what he wished would happen. And then like a cartoon Roger Rabbit landing gear comes out at the last second and saves everybody. Like that's the episode, right?
That's one of the only ones I actually remember from originally.
I think that's probably the most famous one people remember.
Yeah.
So you got these two modes and they are not Twilight Zone darkness. They're more like the Amazing Stories magazine of the 50s, pulpy, right. Weird little short fun stories, right?
Twilight Zone with hugging.
Yeah. Yeah. And why they didn't lead with something a little more out there is one question. A time travel story now doesn't really move the meter to me, right? Like we've seen it time and time again. And this story, which is about this real boring guy who meets a less boring lady back in the past after going, It's just like, you know, he goes back in time and he falls in love with her right away. And then like, you know, there's more time skips and were they meant to be? Were they meant to be? Is it love? Is it love with sacrifice? Da-da-da-da-da-da. And at the end of it, we find out that everybody found their timeline they should have been in. Spoiler, they swap timelines.
At the end, they're like, hey, Buncey trolling. Here's a Honus Wagner baseball card. I was like, no, too late.
There was just nothing new or innovative about what they did in the first episode and why that was the only one anybody had access to on launch day. You know, launch day for the general audience Should have been probably three episodes because they've done that. They've done like everything at once. They've done a few episodes at once.
Yep.
And they've done one episode at once. So they're very malleable when it comes to how they release stuff. And an anthology series in today's climate on a streaming service can't do one episode unless that episode is just like, you know, it's 100%er, right? You can't do it any other way. Otherwise, somebody sees the seller and it's like, meh, and they don't come back to it.
Yeah. I mean, everything about it is so dull. Like seeing the thumbnail where it's like a guy hugging a woman. She's in clearly an old timey dress. Like you can't tell from her shoulders and her hair even what time period it's supposed to be. All you can tell is like she's from olden times. And then the title is The Seller. Like everything about this, it's like a parody of a prestige show. Like it's daring you to never watch it, never mind watch one and never come back, in my opinion. Mark, your thoughts?
It's just so aggressively fine, you know. I mean, I guess it was
yeah.
There's your quote.
It's pleasant. It mm-hmm. it wasn't an unpleasant way to spend 54 minutes or whatever it was, you know. The twists weren't incredibly twisty. You kind of could have seen where it was going. You know, you liked them well enough. And you're like, hey, there's Victoria Pedretti, who you might have just seen in You,
mm-hmm.
season 2.
Yep.
Also remembered her, I believe, from Haunting of Hill House, right?
Yep.
I didn't know the guy at all.
He's the Maze Runner, but he was also a supporting right. cast member on Teen Wolf. He wasn't Teen Wolf. He was Teen Wolf's friend.
See, I had looked him up on IMDb and already forgotten all those incredibly important facts.
I just called him Lil Sisto in my notes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
The thing with that character, though, is why you can't trust him. He has one of those wallet iPhone cases. And I figure the wallet iPhone case is just the worst of all worlds. And I just don't trust anybody who uses that as their running iPhone case.
Yeah. Again, it makes you wonder about what the other episodes are going to be like. Such a small swing for...
Mm. Yeah.
A big show. The big swing version would have been she's reading the letter from him that's coming to the future, and he's talking about how he's found his place back in 1919, and, you know, it's a simpler life. And also, he's about to get on a steamer to go across the Atlantic to take out teenage Hitler.
Right. Yeah.
Which is the only thing I could think of the entire time when he decided to stay back. It's like, oh, you're just going to stay back and chop wood? How about... finding something useful to do with yourself.
Right.
There's a lot of things you could fix instead of the barometer.
That's the thing. I mean, I feel like leaving aside the alt history possibilities of it, it also ignores just the practical underpinnings of the story itself. Because at a certain point, I turned to Dave and was like, the whole reason that she's getting married to this terrible guy is that her family is about to lose the house. Like, they established that immediately. When he shows up and she's all like, are you from the bank? We have until February 5th, blah, blah, blah. Like, clearly that's the reason for this non-love match. And then that just gets thrown out the window. Like, at a certain point, her mother is just absent from the story. Like, bye, Isles. Like, tough luck for you, I guess.
Yeah, she moves. Like, she's not even living in the house when he goes back again.
Right. Also, if we're supposed to buy her amazing future as a singer, like, don't have her sing an entire song flat. Sorry. Terrible.
Vicious.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
She had a nice voice.
I'll
give her.
Well.
She did her own singing.
More for you.
She definitely did her own singing. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, I just feel like we don't need this show. We already have so many anthology shows. We have The Twilight Zone. We have Black Mirror. Like
a show that isn't so down all the time that is an anthology show, I think has a place, like just as change of pace, you know, like a little sweetness.
Yes.
But it's got to be of the same quality as those other shows.
Yeah.
And this show, here's the problem again, based on the one episode we've seen, presumably best foot forward, who knows, just isn't there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm fine with a cheerful Twilight Zone, but this hasn't really provided something to hook onto.
Yeah.
Well, I wish they'd left Brian Fuller, honestly. Because at least then there would be some visual texture and it just wouldn't be this, like, once upon a time, this tells me everything I need to know, which is these are stories. Amazing? Maybe not. Like, it's going to be, like, cheap and unrisky. And that's fine, but it's not. Like, I would rather have something out of the mind of Hannibal than out of the mind of Once Upon a Time.
This really could have used some kind of a Brian Fuller edge or flight of imagination, because he's pretty great I didn't love American Gods, but I really loved Hannibal. Mm-hmm. And he did Pushing Daisies before that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, he's a voice, you know, he's somebody. That's why he keeps getting these shots and then delivering what he wants to deliver. And that apparently upsets a lot of executives who fire him off of things like Star Trek. And
yeah. And American Gods.
And American Gods also.
Yeah. But it's like, why are you so Brian Fullery, Brian Fuller?
Like, they should have let him have a season to do whatever he wanted. And if they didn't like that season, let it go or then do the, you know, this version. I mean, who knows? The next five could be amazing. Who knows?
We're not finding out, I don't think.
When I used to do graphic design, I had clients like that all the time. They would see some project you did and said, I really like that. Now let's do mine. And you're like, okay, but here's why that one was really good. They let me do what I wanted for their business. And they're like, yes, but here are 12 things you absolutely must do. And they're all like, now you've just created a weekend supermarket flyer for my high-end club. And you're like, why do I hate this? You know, like, I feel like he's in the same boat.
It's also a little weird for Apple, given on the track record right now, because on other stuff, they really have let people run with it, you know?
Yeah.
Dickinson is great and very specific and, yep, and odd.
And C is terrible, but also has a vision of terribleness.
For sure.
And Mystic Quest was good. I really enjoyed Mystic Quest.
Yep.
You know, I ripped through that. The Morning Show, you know, got to a good place, I think, by the time it was done. So, they had a pretty, they're developing a pretty decent track record. And it seems to be when they're, you know, they're trusting their creators a little more. Yeah. Who knows what Brian Fuller was up to, but...
Yeah, a lot of weird decisions. One good decision was they kept the theme.
Yeah, agree. This does seem like a relic of the time when everyone feared, you know, Apple TV Plus shows in general were going to be all super duper, like, bland, yes, and middle of
this
the road,
feels like,
and
that
not
terrible
offend
future
anybody.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And this feels like something where it's like, oh, we changed our mind about that, but we still have these episodes to burn off, so let's just quietly dump them in March totally. And hope no one knows.
I think that's totally it. Yeah.
Oh, well.
Do you think that there's a remade version of the original's episode 21, Hell to Pay, in which a bald man, played by E. Hampton Beagle, gets a hairpiece that drives him to murder a lawyer.
Oh, that was turned into a Treehouse of Horror.
That is the second episode that I remember from the original, because I remember them saying, Hell to Pay, it's a killer hairpiece.
We can only hope.
It is time to go around the dial, talking about things we are watching on TV lately. First up, Tara.
Dave has been very patient while I have been hacking through my backlog of 1 million episodes of television that aired while we were on vacation. But one that I watched without him was a series premiere that happened while we were gone of an ABC drama called For Life. So the premise is... Aaron Wallace was wrongfully convicted of drug crimes. He's played by Nicholas Pinnock, who was a supporting character on Counterpart. He was apparently the only nightclub owner who drugs were being sold in his club, and he had nothing to do with it. JK, but that is the premise. And while incarcerated, he has gotten his law degree and now is working on cases trying to overturn the convictions of other wrongfully incarcerated people that he, you know, fellow inmates at the facility where he is, and actually gets to go out thanks to a loophole in the system and argue cases in court where, like, they drive him there, he gets to put on a suit, he argues in court, and then he has to put on his, like, orange uniform again and gets driven back to prison. So this is based on, it's produced by 50 Cent. It's based on the real story of Isaac Wright Jr., who was a paralegal in prison. He was a club owner, and some of the details are the same. You can look him up. He did not get his law degree while he was incarcerated for a variety of reasons, but he does have his law degree now. And while he was in prison, he did get 20 wrongfully convicted inmates released from prison, which is amazing. The other elements of the story are the warden of this prison is a reformer. She is also a lesbian who's married to an attorney general candidate played by Mary Stuart Masterson, who's running against the Bronx DA who led the team that got Aaron Wallace, that's our protagonist, convicted. So while Aaron is frequently in court on behalf of the men he's incarcerated with, the shitty DA Maskins, played by character actor great Boris McGiver, last seen in House of Cards, but as seen in everything, He is laser focused on denying Aaron wins, which he obviously has a systemic advantage in doing. The DA does, obviously, since, for instance, Aaron can call cops as witnesses who then suddenly have their schedules changed, so they're on undercover duty on days that they're supposed to testify. And if he gets rightly pissed off about this and expresses in court that it's bullshit, the judge can then, as she does in the pilot, threaten him with a contempt charge, and in the premiere describe this as a temper tantrum when he pushes back. And he is black, so there's obviously a racial element to these exchanges as well, and this underlines the dimensions of what he has to work against. And there's a whole thing, he has an ex-wife and a daughter, and the toll, there's a, you know, the toll that his incarceration has on their family, but that part is less interesting to me. This is definitely a very normy take on the cruelty and racism of the justice system. It lacks the artfulness of When They See Us or The Wire. But in the way that's all the more impressive that a show with ideas this big even made it onto a network primetime show for normies, like the warden, this reformer, is working on eliminating solitary confinement in her facility. And it's a big deal for that concept even to be presented as a possibility on a mainstream show. And I've talked before about how I have legal show fatigue because they are conservative at best and fascist at worst, and I stand by that. But I hope this show does well enough to bring us into a new age of making defense lawyers and public defenders the TV heroes that they actually are in real life. It's not bad. It's, like, very watchable. Pinnock is great. He's the guy who Olivia Williams' character was having the affair with in the alternate timeline. Mm-hmm. That guy, he's British. You would never know it. His American accent is spectacular. And Boris McGiver is the shitty Bronx DA, is believably shitty. So he's enjoyable to watch even as he's fulminating. So, yeah, check it out. It's on ABC Tuesday nights for life. For my plug, I have a story that I wrote for Primetimer about Mom for its 150th episode, but it's probably not going to go up until after this podcast drops. So instead, I'm going to plug this week's Extra Extra Hot Great, which was a topic from Dave. Dave, do you want to tease it?
It is called Commercial Earworms. We're tasked to bring at least three commercial earworms to the table, and we did. I think we ended up with like 15 or 20 or something like that by the time we were all done.
Yep.
And so listen at your own risk. And it's definitely one of those episodes that you will love hate, because chances are you'll be humming at least two or three of those for the next week after you listen to it. But it was super fun to do.
Try to guess which one jingle all three of us brought. Yeah. I think you'll enjoy it.
Mark, your turn.
Taking a slight break from nonstop CNN and MSNBC watching in a semi-fetal position state, I decided to dip in to this new FX on Hulu situation. If you guys are familiar with it or not familiar with it, now that the Disney Corporation has swallowed the intellectual property of the Fox Corporation, and Disney now owns Hulu and FX, they decided to make Hulu their streaming hub for all the FX shows. So they've now, they're dumping their catalog stuff onto Hulu, and they're introducing a lot of their new shows via sometimes straight to Hulu and sometimes on linear on FX. And I spent a night going through what the new stuff that was on there, and their newest show, which it launches on FX, is Devs, that has Nick Offerman, and it's from Alex Garland, who did Annihilation, which I love, and Ex Machina, which I also love, and has a very similar kind of like tech sci-fi dystopian full of dread atmosphere that mm-hmm. those movies have. And it's about Nick Offerman runs a mysterious tech company in Silicon Valley, spends a lot of his time hanging out inside a giant gold cube.
Same.
The production design on that alone was probably 3/4 of the budget of the show, trying to develop some sort of super intelligent computer program that's going to, this is probably a mild spoiler, but I think kind of just baked into the premise, trying to model out all human behavior. So a pretty ambitious project. I watched the first two episodes. Yeah. They're both up online now. I really liked it. Just, you know, it's a show right now that's 90% atmosphere and like 10% characterization.
Yeah.
But the atmosphere end of it and the sci-fi dread of it all is really appealing to me. I like that stuff. And, you know, if you feel tense all the time and want to feel even more tense in hour-long bursts, as you're wondering, like, how, what's another thing that could be weird and wrong with the world? You know, it's the way you could spend a little bit of time.
Yeah, it's an interesting take on sort of Silicon Valley in the last couple of years, where everybody's sort of like waking up to the fact that these people really shouldn't be running the show. And they have so much power over our daily lives, from everything from just thinking they know better and acting on it with their giant, you know, big data reservoirs. And this is sort of an extension of that. Like, what happens when it runs so amok that they are able to develop a all-encompassing predictive model? One of the things in the episode, again, spoiler, little spoiler, big spoiler maybe, is like they can go backwards in time and using this model to kind of go back and forward. And like one of the things they kind of figure out is like, can we get to like Calvary Hill? And they kind of can. And, you know, like, what does that mean? And the other thing I really enjoyed about the show beyond just this really thick atmospherics is it was really nice to see Nick Offerman not playing Nick Offerman, the man.
Yeah. Nick Offerman is, you've never seen him and probably never thought you'd see him.
Yeah. And he does really well. I find him believable as sort of a kind of phased out of reality figure that has spent too long dreaming and not long enough living. And his ambitions really have exceeded his morality. And he's right on that line, right? Where it's about to go over. And the other thing I liked about Devs, and this is a big spoiler, so...
spoilers ahoy!
I really liked in the first episode where they kind of did a service to the story by making you think that the male character was the lead character. I didn't know anything about the show, so maybe the advertising sort of ruins it, but he is a character that is welcomed into the system, this whole, the secret Devs project. But it turns out he is a foreign spy. And by the end of this episode, he is no longer in the picture. And the story shifts to his live-in girlfriend, who also works at the company, and what her role, figuring out what happened to her boyfriend, also interactions with Nick Offerman, where what her role is going to be moving forward. And it's sort of refreshing to see that. And I don't think it was telegraphed. Like, I think they did a really good job holding that in. Like, a lot of places will do, you know, those shots where it's like, well, this guy's not going to make it or whatever. And I don't think they really betrayed that. And I thought that was nice to see.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I did not necessarily see any of that twist coming. And the way, I won't put the spoiler here, but the way, the method by which that character is dispatched is really incredible and disturbing. And looks amazing. You know, it's just...
yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the... I forgot his name. Kent Kendrell was his name? The Fixer?
Oh,
Zach,
yeah.
Zach Grenier? I don't remember the character's name.
But the tech company's security officer is basically their Mr. Wolf, is shaping up to be a really great villainous character.
He's their Mike Ehrmantraut.
Yeah.
He's a Mike Ehrmantraut without the happy grandpa vibe.
Right.
Yeah. Well, no, he's the Werner Herzog version of Mike Ehrmantraut.
He gives me the creeps, and we're only two episodes in.
Well, he's Mike Ehrmantraut by way of David Lee from The Good Wife, which is who he was. So,
right.
Yes, okay. Of course, he's pure evil.
The second show in my mini binge was Breeders, which stars Martin Freeman and from Everything, and Daisy Haggard from... the unsmiling development executive from Episodes.
Yep.
In which he was great. And then, was it called Back to Life? The one on Showtime, which was also very good.
Mm-hmm.
She's great. And if your first exposure to her was Episodes, as mine was, you would not have known anything about her, because all she does is have a constipated smile and a really bad Southern California accent, but also doing a really spot on version of an incompetent, humorless development executive. And this show, though, it's about, it's doing the stress of parenthood thing, and it's doing it in a really stressful way. It is not a pleasant watch. The first episode was actively unpleasant.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I mean, I think the easy comparison is to go to Catastrophe, but Catastrophe is A, much funnier, and yep. B, the character's relationship is much warmer. That's undergirding everything. So whatever happens and whatever like mean fights they would get into, first of all, it would be hilarious. Second of all, you would not, you know, kind of doubt their goodness as people. This one, it's like, it's so stressful. The pilot episode is about their inability to get their kids to sleep and the lengths they'll go to, which, you know, is every parent's really terrible nightmare, and they're presenting the absolute worst version of it, and it's just pitched at such a incredibly stressful level that it was just the comedy wasn't going through. It was trying to be, you know, a dark comedy, which is normally definitely my jam, but the way in which they attacked it with like so little humanity was was not pleasant. And then I went and watched the second one, and it was slightly less stressful. And it's about getting their kid into a better school, which, you know, another parental nightmare. Not pitched at the same hysterical level as the first one. I don't know if I'm going to stick with that show. Like,
okay,
maybe I'll give it a try. I'm really, you know, I'm a person who will stick with something even when I've long stopped caring just because I'm a completist, but this one might've scared me off enough. Like, I don't know.
This is what I needed to hear. Cause I only watched that first one. And at the end of it, I realized I was grinding my teeth. Like, I obviously don't have kids. And I was like, this is too much for me. Like, I don't need to feel like I'm having a heart attack. Like you, I feel like if anything, you've undersold how exhausting it was to watch and how stressful. Like it felt unrelenting. And I get that that's the point of what they're trying to communicate. Like you're trying to get across the sense of how that feels as a parent, but like, why am I watching that? That's why I don't have kids.
It was, you know, a different kind of stress for me too, because we've been lucky enough. Like we don't have a kid with sleeping issues. Like we have it relatively easy, but it was also like a horrific sliding doors kind of thing to watch. Like, oh my God, this is what it could have been like.
Yeah. You know,
it's like, and what we know other people do go through.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't funny enough to mitigate that just really awful kind of feeling of dread that's going through the whole thing. I mean, dread's not even the right word, because dread is a lower simmering thing.
Right.
This was like,
anxiety. Yes.
It's like someone screaming in your face.
Yeah. All right. So the last show is?
The last show, which was an extremely pleasant surprise, was Dave, which is a show about a satirical white rapper on the loose in Los Angeles named Little Dicky, who apparently is a real life satirical rapper of whom I was not aware. Pretty charming. It kind of has the vibe of like, you know, I've seen someone compare it to Atlanta. It's not nearly on the level of Atlanta, but it's like Atlanta meets Flight of the Conchords to me. I found it really funny, really charming. He's an interesting, you know, presence in the middle of it. It's really funny. It's just got like some in complete opposition to what's going on with Breeders, got a much more laid back vibe. It's got some good rap stuff in there. Like at the end of the first episode, he's trying to get YG to do a verse on a track for him, and he's spent all his bar mitzvah money on it. And so he has to track YG down at the studio. And then YG makes him go viral by catching a freestyle on his Instagram story. And it's actually pretty incredible. And they've clipped it and put it up if you want to look it up. But it's a pretty awesome freestyle. And I'm not a huge hip hop guy, but I enjoyed that. But the show itself is actually really funny. Second episode is about his attempt to get discovered is taking him. And the answer is to perform at the memorial service for a young fan who has died. Oh. His parents want him to rap at it. So that's the kind of like situations that show's getting into.
Okay.
That's a high recommend for me though. If anything I said sounds even vaguely appealing, like I think it just really works. It has a real like tone and vision behind it. The comedy is really funny. It's a very FX-y show in the best way.
All right. That was one I ruled out based on the poster, so I'm glad to hear you say
that. Poster's terrible. Big recommend.
Sarah D. Bunting.
In the immortal words of Tara Ariano, I'll keep this short. The show in question, Jersey Shore Family Vacation, has recently returned to MTV, but I had like a whole season sitting on the office DVR for reasons. I guess I wasn't aware that it was on, and then it kept getting pushed down the most recent list. This is super interesting DVR process. You're welcome. So anyway, I've been trying to catch up so that this doesn't happen again. And I'm really struck by the same way that I always say that the Teen Mom franchises are this really like extremely long form, extremely low key sociological experiment that it's basically like the 35 Up series, but with a bunch of ads in it telling you to quit smoking. The like Jersey Shore Family Vacation is starting to turn into that, but Jersey Shore's lane is like sort of the evolution of reality stars and like what happens to them once this really is their job. You're also thinking about anger management and toxic relationships and how those are or are not managed for people who are in the public eye and conducting their crappy relationships via Instagram in performance all the time. So, I mean, what I'm really trying to say is that Ronnie Ortiz Magro needs to get off TV like yesterday and not come back on it for 3 years and seriously like work on a farm in Montana where he can just like occasionally go to the edge of the property and just scream. Because he has a lot of issues and he needs to not be in this extremely fake environment, fakely working them out. But on the other hand, watching his roommates, like watching a friend group contend with this kind of grown-up problem with like a, you know, found family member who's having a lot of problems, many of which he brings on himself and many of which are like really not okay. And like the different group texts and people referring to the different group texts, like that something about it speaks to me in terms of like, I don't know, how groups construct narratives for each other as well as on TV.
Yeah.
Not to be giving MTV, you know, like a Peabody award or anything, but maybe they should get one. Like it, I think that a lot of their programming really forces us to examine how we as a society are dealing or not with certain problems.
Yeah.
So anyway, but watching two or three of these a day is really fucking with my head. Also, I think I may accidentally have a master's in psychology now. So that's a plus, but yeah, I'm at Tomato Nation on Twitter. If anyone wants to talk to me about ongoing Jersey Shore Family Vacation dramas on and off screen.
Well, I mean, once you've caught up, when the new season starts, this is the situation coming back from prison. So that's going to be a whole other wrinkle.
Yeah. I mean, in the beginning of the previous season, he literally like pulls a Goodfellas and is like, he gets into the back of an Escalade and he goes, take me to jail. But instead of popping a pill, he's like eating some candy. It's kind of amazing. Like his evolution into this like avuncular, rusty from Ocean's 11, constantly snacking person it has really been something to see. In a good way. I suspect he's a Republican though, so
yeah, probably.
Speaking of criminals, speaking of criminals and FX on Hulu, for my plug, The Blotter Presents, which you can hear, it has dropped now if you're listening to this, episode 135 with my esteemed colleague Eve Beatty. We're talking about FX's foray into the unscripted true crime space, although this is super scripted, but whatever, nonfiction. It's about that dude who insisted that his dad was the Zodiac. Spoiler. We're also talking about Hustlers and its profound pro-labor message wrapped in a lot of body glitter, and we loved it. Spoiler again. So, yes, that's The Plotter Presents, wherever you download your podcasts.
Babylon Berlin Season 3 dropped on Netflix. This season is like almost as long as the two seasons before it. Tara, you were saying had a slightly different feel to it, but you thought the actual mystery, the case that they were investigating, was more compelling.
Yes.
Explain yourself.
At the beginning of the season, we find out that the mobster, the owner of the nightclub where a lot of the action in the first two seasons takes place, he is financing a movie, this like musical German expressionist situations, very of its time, very dramatique, probably. In the middle of a musical number, we see somebody tampering with a light up on a rafter, and then it falls and it crushes the, it falls directly on the leading lady. And so this is one of many problems that occurs on the set. It seems to be an organized campaign of sabotage. But the question is, who's behind it and who stands to gain and why is this happening? And at the same time, this guy's partner has just gotten out of prison. He has a relationship with this guy's wife. So that's interesting. So that's sort of the through line that runs underneath it, as well as the ongoing trial of Greta, the maid who in season two planted a bomb in the political cop chief's house that blew him up and also accidentally his daughter. So the main detective, Gédéon, is still investigating that and trying to track down the Nazis who tricked her into doing this by posing as communists. Those are just two much more cohesive and coherent threads to follow while not sacrificing anything about what makes the show like interesting and weird and fun. I think
maybe just like now that we're in season three, the newness of it all, you know, the setting both in time and place, you're used to a little bit more now. So I felt like that joy of discovery element was not there so much in season three, but the mystery is well drawn, and at the core of it, like you're saying, there's this cursed movie production and everything sort of starts there and everything swims around it. Like, it's not just a mystery, but it's also like what's going on socially right now in 1928 to 29 in Germany. So, you know, you do have communists, you do have the National Socialists, the brown shirts, and what's going on there. So it's
stock
not,
market speculation is also
buying a margin, everything like that's happening too. So it does a good job of actually using its setting to good effect rather than just it being for eye candy, which it has a lot of. Like, I'm still fascinated by the elevator in the police station that doesn't stop between floors. You have to actually hop on and hop off.
But just go
by danger of decapitation. Yeah. And the other just like visual thing that I really appreciate about this series, which is like apparently the most expensive TV show they've ever made in Germany. And it sort of shows because it's very ambitious. But when they are doing computer graphics to show buildings that obviously no longer exist, there is a certain crispness to them that you don't usually see. Like, you can tell that they're computer generated, obviously, because they just would never exist today in that setting. But there is a certain crispness and colorfulness to it that you don't usually get with CG graphics that makes it feel very real's not the right word, but it makes it feel very true to the time period and the setting. Whereas like usually they kind of like soften or muddy things down just to get away with it, you know? And here they sort of just embrace that it is as crisp as the camera would capture it. And if it looks a little off, that's fine. And I think that's fine.
Well, I also think it contributes to the sort of overall visual look and feel of the show, that it contributes to it feels to me part of the kind of uncanny unrealness of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has, the whole show has a kind of surreality to it.
Yeah, because there's like mystic elements that aren't really mystic and stuff like that. So they're not afraid to bring in more fantastical things, but they're all still real. Yeah, it all sort of works. It's a mishmash of so many elements. And that's like one of the great things about the show, that it can kind of blend all these weird things into a compelling mystery show, mm-hmm. a detective show. And it does.
Yeah, between Babylon Berlin this past weekend and Narcos Mexico the weekend before, it's been a good couple of weeks for subtitled shows on Netflix. So thank you for both of those. And I just want to also add, we get a whole scene in this season of one of the villain characters, like explaining point by point how stock shorting works. And I watched that scene. I was really paying attention. I've also seen The Big Short. I still don't understand how stock shorting works. And I've just finally accepted. I will never understand. It's not for me to know. It's none of my business.
It is time for The Canon. Presenting this week is our guest, Mark Lazanti. Take it away, Mark.
Toast of London, an original production of the UK's Channel 4, brought its three seasons to Netflix in late 2017, and with it, the booming BBC broadcaster on performance-enhancing Quaalude's voice of Matt Berry. Yes, those of a stateside may have been first introduced to him via the IT Crowd or the cherished 1-2 comedy nerd punch of The Mighty Boosh and Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. Or maybe some latecomers through his ongoing horny What We Do in the Shadows vampire, Laszlo. But it's Toast of London's U.S. streaming arrival that offers the uncut Berry experience. It's a show that no less critical luminary than Television Without Pity founder Tara Ariano has declared in a tour de force Twitter review, all caps, very, no caps, dumb. And it's Toast of London's very dumb, but very funny third episode of season three, Ham on Toast, that I'm submitting for immediate canon enshrinement. Away we go. So Matt Berry stars as Stephen Toast, a washed-up actor of stage, screen, and most crucially, the voiceover booth. We'll begin in that Scramble Soho Studios booth, as virtually every Toast of London episode does. I'd say every single episode, but just gonna hedge virtually because I didn't go and fact-check that. Just be confident it's pretty much everyone. Ham on Toast opens with Stephen's voiceover script, as it usually does, offering very little in the way of direction, allowing him to flex his acting chops. Clip one.
Nay.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's all it says here.
Stephen, you think the nay is probably meant to be the sound of a horse?
You want me to make the sound of a horse?
Yeah, I'm guessing the neigh is just a rough indication. So just do the sound of a horse.
All right. Neigh!
Hi, Stephen, this is Clem Fandango. Can you hear me?
Yes.
The feeling here is that it didn't sound much like a horse.
What?
Would it help that instead of a neigh, you could try a whinny?
A what?
Yeah, we think a whinny might be better than a neigh.
What's the difference?
Just do another horse sound.
I think whinny rather than neigh.
Winnie!
Stephen, was that a whinny? Because it sounded a lot like a neigh.
Jesus Christ, look, I got things to do. And one of those is not sitting with you two pilchards making horse noises. What are you doing?
Just Googling whinny and neigh.
Oh, for fuck's... Why don't you just bring a horse in here? Yeah? I mean, I'm sure he'd get a nail it first time.
Health and safety issue, Stephen.
Sorry, Stephen, I've got this so wrong. It's actually... Neighbours.
Neighbours?
Yeah, it's my fault. The whole script didn't print out. I just got a bit of it.
You're an idiot. Are we rolling? Neighbours, returning to Channel 5 this autumn. Don't miss it. Every weekday at 5:30 p.m.
Toast torture by knob-twirling studio douches Danny Bear and the delectably named Clem Fandango is among my favorite all-time running gags. If there were canon just for running gag subcategory,
oh my God.
The YouTube supercut of Steven, this is Clem Fandango, can you hear me? Yes, yes I can hear you, Clem Fandango. Fandango trolls alone would sail in to the inaugural class. But this episode isn't about the studio, that's just the cold open, nor is it really about the first plot points introduced, for Toast's cranium-denting crash through his flat's rickety stairs and a subsequent visit by his brother Blair, an upper-crusty, D-handed Falklands war vet who wears a prosthetic yellow kitchen glove with one-third the regal menace of Thanos' Infinity Gauntlet. For these developments will play important roles throughout. Blair announces that their father has fallen ill and is ready to divvy up the family estate, and it's essential they don't let father leave the money to the dog, or worse, the servants. It's time for Blair to get the country castle and Toast the London pad, which would finally free Stephen from roommate Ed's lovemaking marathons, which are a topic for another time. another canon entry. Ham on Toast is about something much more real, about something we've all had experience with. Falling head over heels, arse over bushy mustache, in love with prestige television's most unstoppable charisma machine, Jonathan Daniel Ham. What's that you say? There's no such thing as charisma? And heaven forfend, you don't know and adore Ham? Toast is right there with you, your Virgil through a bleak, hamless underworld. But first, let Toast's agent Jane, after handing over a payment from the BBC made entirely in small coins, explain what's up. In clip two.
Why are you all glammed up, Jane?
I'm meeting John Ham.
I've literally never heard of him.
Probably one of the best actors in the world. Surprised you've literally never heard of him. He's fabulous, sexy, and terrifically good-looking. He's on a short break from filming that Tommy Cooper film in Dorset. I'm meeting him upstairs at the Colonial. Why don't you come along and say hello?
No, I'm not interested.
He is hugely charismatic.
Is he indeed? You know something? I've never met anyone with any charisma, ever. It's a complete myth. Even that time I was introduced to Sean Connery, it was like meeting a chair or a dead rabbit.
Well, everybody, people of every sex and all sizes and shapes and ethnic groups, adore her.
I'm not interested. But it just so happens I now have the exact money to pay my bar tab at the Colonial. So I'll walk with you.
He does, in fact, escort Jane to the Colonial, and which does, in fact, lead to the first Ham on Toast encounter. Oh, boy. Clip three is coming in ham hot.
I'm sure you won't stay for a drink.
Jane, like I told you, I've absolutely no interest. What? So? Jane.
Oh, how lovely to see you, Johnny. This is Stephen Toast. He's not staying.
No. Well, it's nice to meet you anyway.
Where are you off to? Home to Ed?
Who's Ed? Is that your husband? Are you homosexual?
No, I was...
Do you know I might stay?
Ham! The infatuation is so instant and total that an ensuing encounter with a comely groupie named Pookie Hook, seeking modeling and acting tips, is an inexplicable blow-off to the normally incorrigible Pookie Hound. Instead, Toast will tail Ham to the Savile Row to help with confusing British shirt sizes, a thing any of us would have done in similar sartorial circumstances. And it goes so well. Every shirt looks great on Ham, despite the inscrutable English shirt sizing. Toast decides to do a deep Ham dive. Where should he start? You know where he should start. Grab the popcorn and tighten up your head bandages. It's time to visit 1960s Madison Avenue, clip four.
Are you a fan of John Ham, Ed?
Yes. I've got every series of Mad Men on DVD. It's pretty much the best show on telly.
Yeah, I'd heard it's great. I'd love to see them.
Well,
now. I'd love to see it now.
All right.
If I could see them now.
Oh, I'll try and dig them out.
Quick as you can.
What's he He's insane!
Shit.
Now that Toast had a taste of Ham, he's desperate for more. And as far as logic luck would have it, Ham has temporarily moved into a flat across the street from him. He swipes Ham's digits from Jane's Rolodex, rings him up to lock him down for some drinks, and obliviously steamrolls right through another improbable Pookie liaison. Once again, there's no time for Pookie. It's all Ham all the time. And that night, waking from his slumber in a hat and sleeping gown, straight out of the It's About to Get Real for Ebenezer Scrooge collection, Ham's torturous, delicious proximity comes into play as Toast peeps him getting ready for bed. It's time for a musical interlude. And if you haven't seen Toast of London, yeah, this is a thing that happens regularly. Matt Berry sings its earworm theme song and has cathedral-quality pipes, and he's not afraid to use them in the silliest, stupidest manner possible. Clip number five.
I've got myself in a terrible jam. I hit my head and now I fancy a man. I should feel up, I've never felt so down. And they say I'm the worst actor in town.
This is the place where we point out that Toast should just let himself love whomever he wants to love without attributing it to blunt force head wounds. But head trauma or not, it's been a while since Toast's been in love. So long, in fact, he's making Ham, a mixtape of marching band music, by sticking a cassette recorder microphone into the horn of an old-timey Victrola. Kids, ask your grandparents what any of that means. Roommate Ed finds Toast's obsession unhealthy, but Toast, undaunted, throws himself ever deeper into the yawning maw of Ham's charisma. There's a walk in the park with ice cream cones, some light football, a mutual splaying across a flannel blanket among well-stocked picnic baskets. Tragically for Toast, the most fun day of his life dead ends in a spurred invitation to visit Toast's expiring dad. Ham demurs because he's got a movie to shoot. So Toast does what any rational, ham-addled paramour would do. He breaks into his crush's flat, tries on all his Don Draper suits, and sloshes around in old-fashioned while smelling his bed. The normal stuff any of us would do. I wasn't going to throw to a clip here, but what happens next, which involves the phrase special ham-shaped indentation, and John Hamm rising from a mattress hidey hole wearing a cardboard mask with some British TV antiques guy we're maybe supposed to know, demands it. Here's clip 6.
Toast, what are you doing here?
Ham, it's you. Your window was open. I couldn't resist climbing in.
Yes, well, I spent a lot of time hiding in my bed to avoid the paparazzi. It has a special ham-shaped indentation so that it appears to be flat.
What's with the mask?
It's Lovejoy, the antiques guy.
Do you wear that so you're not recognized?
No. I just went to the shop. They had a bunch of them. Mr. Bean, the Queen, Camilla, Prince Charles. I just like the Lovejoy.
You certainly are a madman.
All right, let's wrap up this exquisite nonsense, shall we? Blair rings and the locusts are descending upon Father's house, ready to pick clean their rightful inheritance. Toast must hie to the family estate, which features the world's tallest castle for reasons that will very soon become important, with Ham in tow. Here's clip 7.
I, Gonville Toast, I wish for my paintings, my gold, and my dog to be buried with me.
Paintings, gold, dog, to be buried with you upon your death.
Father, I'm here! Your son has arrived!
Who said that?
That's your other son, Father. The actor.
The actor? I thought he was dead!
No, Father, that's just what you tell everybody because you hate him. Is that you, Toast? We're at the top in Father's bedroom. Come quickly!
And my firearms collection shall be left to Annie Lennox. And finally...
Hurry up, Toast!
And finally...
I leave my entire estate, my fortune, and my freehold properties, both here and in London, too. John Hamm.
John Hamm.
What?
Oh, no! No, Father! Wait!
Father! Wake up, Father! Wake up! Oh, dear God!
I believe your father has passed.
This is your doing, Toast, you bloody fool! Why did you bring John Hammond here? Everyone knows about his charm and charisma. I'm going to kill you!
Whoa!
Toast!
Whoa!
Oh, dear.
Oh.
Someone give me a cab. I don't like being around dead people.
And with a simple 200-step tumble down the world's longest castle staircase and a callous dismissal by Hollywood's most charismatic star, the ham-shaped indentation in Toast's head is finally healed. Gonville leaves Ham everything, Blair nothing, and Toast the wistful memories of what might have been if Dick Whitman had a cooler attitude about dead guys. Ham on Toast was, as promised, all caps, very, no caps, dumb. A real and lasting accomplishment in the dumb comedy and ham appreciation arts. It's bursting with musical interludes, Clem Fandangos, Pookie's hookses, and even a brief but meaningful Ray Bloody Purchase cameo. It's got it all. Please put it in the canon where it rightly belongs. We can't leave it to the dogs and servants. Also, it's John Hamm's birthday.
Hey! I should go first?
Sure.
I mean, I guess since I was...
Name dropped
so much. It is very dumb. I have advocated on this podcast many times for dumb comedy as an aficionado of same, particularly in light of the recent extremely good examples of it. I think you should leave with Tim Robinson, the Bash Brothers, both on Netflix, and this, which we devoured in, I think, 2 days, all three seasons, after we discovered it last fall, very belatedly. And I think when Dave talked about this on the podcast, he was mad at people who hadn't told us about it. And I stand by that. You all fucked up. few notes about this. It's one of the many shows that knows it's just always funny to give characters dumb names. It's always funny. Brooklyn Nine-Nine knows this. 30 Rocks knows this. And while you were talking, Mark, I looked up a partial list of stupid names of Toast of London. And some of these are not even characters that we ever meet. They're just like names on the wall behind Jane of like her clients. Yeah. Vic Titball, Betty Pimples, Hamilton Meathouse, Clancy Moped, of course, Pookie Hook, meet in this episode. Ricky Seasack, Jenny Spasm. I mean, I could go on. Like, it's just always funny. And what's great about this is that John Hamm, also a funny name. Yeah. Like, if your lead is Stephen Toast, you know a John Hamm who likes to do incredibly stupid comedy. Yes, you hire him to do Ham on Toast, this very episode that we have just watched. I'm shocked to know that you did not get the Lovejoy reference. Lovejoy, of course, an early Ian McShane, well, not early in his career, but an Ian McShane vehicle that was one of the mainstays of A&E before it devolved into all live PD programming, was on for many, many years.
Wow.
I love the casting of Brian Blessed as Toast's dad, the only actor in Britain with a voice more sonorous than Matt Berry's. It's perfect to have him in bed expiring. But yeah, Matt, Toast's ongoing confusion about his feelings about John Hamm and his charisma is a delight. It would be hard to narrow this show down to just one episode because they are all very good, but this is an excellent starting point and a very, very good, very good presentation. Thank you so much for letting us watch it again. I was crying listening to the clips. Oh God, Clem Fandango, you son of a bitch. This is maybe not my very favorite cold open, but really one of the better ones. So really from start to finish, excellent episode. Great pick. Thank you, Mark. Should Sarah go next or Sarah go last?
Yeah, go Sarah.
Sarah should go next.
Thank you, oily freeloaders. a little story about this. There's something about, like, I was already basically like on board with this episode before the musical interlude, but there's something about you're the worst actor in the world. Just like this arena rock flourish at the end of it. That I started singing it to the dog who Bear enjoys pretending, even though he looks like a winter hat with teeth because he's fat, that he's starving to death. Mm-hmm. So I'm singing to him while I'm fixing his dinner. You're the worst actor in the world. Woo! When my husband, an actor, comes home and is like, I don't really appreciate that. And then the dog got upset because we were like discussing this. And he was like, but no one's feeding me. And also you're fighting. So now we're just singing it like to everyone, like you're the worst puppy in the world. You're the worst husband in the world. It's amazing. And then always beat. Woo. I also enjoy that there's always these weird Shakespeareanishly pretentious emphases on the wrong syllable.
Yeah.
You're barking up the wrong acorn. Like that's not a thing. And that's also not a thing. The Sean Connery line, it was like meeting a chair or a dead rabbit. It just keeps happening. And then I think the dad does it also.
Yeah.
At some point, like, the actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like so. There are just so many little tiny things, like just the way that it's shot, like this cheap 70s or 80s Beeb sitcom when they're sitting at the table. The whole bit about like, well, you know, we have to return the rope too. He needs to tie his horse trailer to his Maserati or whatever it was. Like he's watching Mad Men in a hard hat with a box of old timey popcorn. It was just so much fun. There's no dead air in it. And once again, John Hamm, best sport in Hollywood. This was delightful. I think we kind of heard the whole episode again, and I have zero problem with that. Excellent presentation. Excellent episode. Thank you so much for making us watch it. Dave.
Yes. Thanks, Mark. That was a really fun presentation. I have one problem with this episode, and only one, is that we don't get the full Clem Fandango response.
Yes.
Yeah, he didn't get upset enough at Clem in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this episode is really funny, and I think Tara hit it exactly on the head. This might not be the best episode of Toast of London, but I think it is like a fantastic and quality entry point for anybody who has not seen the series, if they just want to sample one and see what it's about. Because I remember watching the first episode and not really like having a feel for exactly what it was trying to do. And also pilots thinking, okay, yeah. I kind of, yeah, but let's go on. And then more we went on, like way more I got into it. Like, so I would say like, if anything here today piqued your interest, do go ahead and start with season 3, episode 3, Ham on Toast, because there's no penalty in doing so. It's not really a show with a giant amount of throughput beyond his general,
not at all,
sad fortunes in it, the London acting
fortunes.
Scene. Yeah. Fortunes. I would say, yeah, go ahead and watch this episode. I think it's a really smart canon induction. And, you know, I said my piece about Toast of London and the failure of our audience to bring it to our attention before. So
you're all on notice.
Yeah, you're still on notice for that. Quality, dumb comedy.
Yep.
There is a certain, even more special comedy segment, dumb British comedy.
Yep.
And
yeah,
this is the exemplar for that.
100%.
So let's put this to the official vote. Tara Ariano, what say you?
Absolutely.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yay.
And I'm going to say yes as well. So. That means Toast of London, Series 3, Episode 3, Ham on Toast. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
The casting agents for ABC's The Brides, which is a Dracula adjacent property, because they cast literally the only person who could make me watch that shtees as Dracula, Goran Visnjic. Yay! I'm in!
And loser of the week?
I just want to add, it also features a crush object of another person on this podcast, Gina Torres, Dave's girlfriend.
Oh, yeah?
One of the brides.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Loser of the week. Ooh, current / disqualified drag race contestant, Sherry Pie. This was a fast-moving story you can see from our doc because it has the headlines as they go. First of all, allegedly a sexual predator. It's real bad. More details. Per spoilers, she gets pretty far in the season, so it would be hard to cut around her. And she's been disqualified. So what happened was Sherry Pie posed with a number of different people as a casting director in order to dupe them into putting themselves on tape doing sexually compromising things. And when this came out, Drag Race basically immediately had to be like, she's not on the show anymore. But I have still not started the season due to the aforementioned catching up. So I don't know how this actually works, except that there was a message at the beginning of the most recent aired episode, because as of the, she didn't actually make it into the first one, I think. It was like a two-parter. And then Kevin O'Keefe, past and future guest of the show, tweeted something to the effect of like, it would be weird to watch this as a not online person being like, disqualified, what? And then do a quick Google and be like, oh no, because it's a very, very bad story and not funny at all and bad. And on top of all that, RuPaul's Netflix sitcom, AJ and the Queen, also got canceled last week after one season. So rough times for Miss RuPaul all around.
Speaking about rough times, you know what time it is?
It's good time.
Welcome back. This is the third game time of the season. Season scores: Sarah D. Bunting, 1 point. Tara Ariano, 1 point. Value guess, 0. Today we are playing Letter Flip from Chris Billig, the Billig of Good, and Dan Cassino.
Damn you, Cassino!
Ooh. That's a new one.
That guy. Yeah. Yes, thank you. I believe that comes from Brendan Brezzo.
Oh,
sent me that.
Nice.
So they both earned themselves an extra credit topic for their troubles. Here's how we play today's game. They have flipped two consecutive letters in the titles of existing shows to come up with new TV shows. Can you name the letter flip shows based on the description I will give you? So here's an example, not a TV show, but just to get you into the mood.
Sure.
For example, if we asked you about a podcast where hosts talk about TV while tossing their pet swine snacks, the answer would be Extra Hog Treat. Swapping two letters.
Okay.
Oh,
putting the G and the T in Extra Hot Grace. So it's a little bit of a thinker. So I'll give you more time for each one.
Okay.
But the descriptions will give you, definitely point you in the right direction.
Okay.
These are very good descriptions.
Okay,
so
good.
It's not as much of a crapshoot as you may think. So let's find out the current steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah D. Bunting has 0 steel meals. I have 2 steel meals plus an extravaganza gong. Valued guests have 1 steel meal. So, Mark, how this works is if somebody else gives a wrong answer and you know the correct answer, you can quickly say steel meal, and then you can jump in and steal their points.
Let's throw it to Picky to see who will be going first today.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Our order today, Tara, Sarah, Mark. We have 30 questions. In the interest of time, we have no gross worth equalizer challenge zones today.
Okay.
Are we ready to play Letter Flip?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tara. Who filled Reese Witherspoon's house with small potato side dishes? Was it Kerry Washington?
Little fries everywhere.
Little fires everywhere turned into little fries everywhere. Good for 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
You want more naked shows, EHG? How about this one about the Fisher Naked Funeral Home?
Six feet neuter?
Correct.
Wow.
Mark Lazanti, here comes your first question. David Boreanaz plays an acute LA detective. Will his obtuse team keep him from standing up for what's right?
Wow.
Angle.
Oh,
correct.
Thanks for the easy one. I never would have got 6 feet neuter.
Back to Tara.
Yes.
Lorraine Toussaint's character from Orange is the New Black is the next target for Jodie Comer's international assassin.
Killing V.
Killing Eve, Killing V. Correct. Sarah D. Bunting. Improv comedians take over the properties of people deep in debt. Improv comedians take over the properties of people deep in debt.
people.
Properties of people deep in debt?
Yeah. Do you have an idea what the original show is? Might help you by saying it out loud.
Improv comedians could be a bunch of things. It could be Saturday Night Live. That could be any other improv show. It could be The State. I mean, it's not The State.
I will give you that. This show in particular has improv comedy throughout. It is an improv show. It is not featuring improv comedians necessarily doing sketches.
Okay. Yeah, that doesn't help me. Sorry. Best non?
Steel Meal?
Steel Meal from Mark.
Whose lean is it anyway?
That's
how
correct.
You do it.
Oh, that's gorgeous. Nice work.
All right, nice steal, Mark. And here's your regular question. Gordon Shumway becomes the head of one of Melmac's biggest labor unions.
AFL.
Correct. Tara.
Yes.
Stan Smith solves very basic math problems for the CIA in this animated series.
I don't know who Stan Smith is, so I don't know.
Stan Smith solves very basic math problems for the CIA in this animated series.
Oh, wait. Shit.
Say it out loud.
Okay, I think it's American Dad. Oh, American Ad.
Correct. Sarah. The biggest issue in the Chicago hospital is email reply subject line etiquette.
The Chicago hospital is emails. The Chicago hospital. I don't.
You do.
I mean, Ray. Chris and Dan, you're terrible. Terrible people.
Mark Lazanti. Tom Selleck's classic character becomes a patent and a copyright attorney.
Magnum IP.
Tara.
Yes.
An earthquake sends Marshall, Will, and Holly to a land with parking areas as far as the eye can see.
Lots in space.
Incorrect. Land of the Lots. Wrong group of characters.
Crap.
Ouch.
Back to Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
This sci-fi film follow-up is about the vessels one's ashes get put in after you're renewed at 30.
Logan's Urn?
Correct. All right, this is for Mark Lazanti. This will take us into our score break. Reality show in which Russian royalty are reduced to evaluating items of historical value on the Vegas Strip. Reality show.
Oh, Pawn Star.
Pawn Stars. Correct. That is good for a point. And that will bring us into our first score break, please, Star.
Very close game. Sarah and I are tied with 3 points each. Mark leads with 5 due to very artful equalizer deployment. And
Steel Meal.
Good answers. Oh, yes, yes. Sorry, Steel Meal deployment.
Tara, back to you. This is what you get for electing Boris Johnson as a mayor of a city of ancient Greek legend. Any idea?
No.
Nothing?
None.
It's one of the harder ones here.
I don't know what city of ancient Greek legend is being referred to.
The show, Troy, Fall of a City. The new show, Tory, Fall of a City. That's one for our UK listeners,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, never heard of that show.
I think it's on Netflix or Amazon.
Yeah. Sure.
To Sarah. Mother and daughter, Allison Janney and Anna Faris, bond over their shared love of online gaming.
MMO?
Correct. From mom to MMO.
Mm-hmm.
Mark. Kiefer Sutherland and his team find the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
42.
Correct. Tara.
Yes.
Viridian Dynamics finds that it's optimal to feed its employees with some level of frequency.
Okay, well, the show is Better Off Ted.
Viridian Dynamics finds that it is optimal to feed its employees with some level of frequency.
Better off EDT?
Better off fed.
Oh, wow.
God damn it.
All right, this is question
17. Oh, it's EBT. That's what I was thinking of. Yes.
This is question 17, guys.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
For Sarah. Richard Mulligan is an unlucky fisherman, even after his daughters moved back in to help.
Empty nets.
Empty nets from Empty Nest. Correct. This is for Mark. A teenage doctor leads Dungeons and Dragons sessions after his shifts at the hospital.
Give me that one more time.
A teenage doctor leads Dungeons and Dragons sessions after his shifts at the hospital.
Doogie Howser DM.
Doogie Howser Dungeon Master.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Boy.
Good thing I'm a nerd.
This is question 19. For Tara.
Mm-hmm.
TV dad James Anderson is a compulsive gambler in this classic 50s radio and TV sitcom. Well, they all can't be recent, huh?
Okay.
You can blame Chris Billig, the Billig of Good, and Dan Cassito. It's a well-known show.
Okay.
TV dad James Anderson is a compulsive gambler in this classic 50s radio and TV sitcom.
My Three Snows. I have no idea.
Father Knows Bets.
Oh.
All right. Back to Buncey. The Bartlett administration works to get the support of a sweaty congressman whose vote could go either way.
Ew. Wait. Okay. Is it the Wet Swing?
Wet Swing. Ew. Mark Lazanti, the power of Grayskull just makes Prince Adam really, really blasé about everything.
Eh, man.
And the Masters of the Universe, correct.
God.
Tara.
Yes.
Jason Schwartzman and Zach Galifianakis have to solve mysteries involving super aggressive frat guys.
Broed to death.
Correct. Sarah. Tim Roth is a Hawaiian police consultant who can tell anything about you from the patterns in your floral neckwear.
From the patterns in your floral neckwear?
Let me read that
neckwear?
Again for you. Tim Roth is a Hawaiian police consultant who can tell anything about you from the patterns in your floral neckwear. Do you know the original show we're talking about?
Yes. I was like, wait, what? The original show is Lie to Me, so this must be Lay to Me.
Oh, you are correct. All right, this is
Mark's groan. See, it's not a Dan Cassino game if you're not a little bit mad about it.
Or a big bit mad about it.
This is for Mark. We'll take us into our second score break. An apartment full of nerdy Caltech grad students works on how to protect the shirts of the Bloods and the Crips from messy foods. Once again, an apartment full of nerdy Caltech grad students works on how to protect the shirts of the Bloods and the Crips.
The Bib Gang Theory.
The Bib Gang Theory is correct. Oh, yeah. And
Casino.
I was like diagramming that in the air with my fingers.
All right, updated scores. Everybody has two questions coming at you.
All right, well, I am pulling up the rear with 4 points. Sarah has 7 points. Mark in the lead with 9 points.
Okay.
Oh!
So it is Mark's to lose, starting back with you, Tara.
Yes.
A young investigator is paired with William Conrad, a DA who prefers sitting in the rear of aeroplanes.
Oh.
Do you know the show we're talking about?
I mean, I thought it was Jake and the Fat Man. I don't know how this works.
A young investigator is paired with William Conrad, a DA who prefers sitting in the rear of aeroplanes.
I can't get there. I don't have it.
Anybody?
No.
Jake and the Aft
Man. The Aft Man. God damn it.
So screwed.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, you need to get this. Hulu dramatization of the case of Dee Dee Blanchard, whose mother forced her to pretend to be a cute little kitty.
The cat. Thanks, Picky.
All right, Mark, get this to win. The law firm of McKenzie, Brackman, Cheney, and Kuzak opens a Birmingham office.
AL Law.
AL Law, correct. All right, nice. You've clinched it, but let's play it out. Tara? A low-level Berlin-based spy finds out that an alternate reality version of himself is both a total badass and a British jerk.
Counter Pratt.
All right, Sarah. Picky knew you were playing today. In the criminal justice system, family-sized vehicle offenses are considered especially heinous.
I'm sorry. Could you read it again?
In the criminal justice system, family-sized vehicle offenses are considered especially heinous.
Oh, finally. Finally, it's right. Law and Order, SVU, or SUV, shit. SUV,
fuck. Writing a check for next year of the TV world.
Yes, fuck. Thank you.
All right, here's our last question. I will say that Dan Casino had one question for this, and Chris had another, and Dan said we can't use Chris's, so we're using Chris's. For Mark. Dick Wolf goes a little off his normal genre for this show about a pornographer filming ambitious sex acts in the Windy City.
Chicago DP.
Chicago DP is the correct answer.
Oh, no.
And final scores, please, Tara.
Oh, wow.
God.
Very close game for everyone but me. I had 5 points. Sarah finished with 9 points. Mark is our victor with 11 points.
Nice. Getting back on the
board. I objectively got the easiest clues, just so everyone feels good about that.
The questions are randomized,
nope,
and you get
great.
What you get.
Yep.
We have this tiebreaker we no longer need. We will now play for an additional steel meal for future use. So as soon as you think you know the answer, shout it out.
Okay.
Tim Allen works on his upper back muscles by never sitting down.
Lats man standing.
Lats man standing is correct. Tara gets one more steel meal, but today belongs to Mr. Mark Lazanti.
Valued guest.
Congratulations, Mark. Well done.
Great work, Mark.
Thanks, guys.
Chris and Dan, see me after class.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We talked up a storm about the Apple TV Plus resurrection of Amazing Stories before going around the dial with stops at For Life, Devs, Breeders, Dave, Jersey Shore Family Reunion, and Babylon Berlin. We toasted to Mark's canon presentation of Toast of London, Ham on Toast. Ha! We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Mark was the winner of this week's Letter Flip Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
God,
Sarah D. Bunting,
I thought he was dead,
and Mark Lazanti,
charisma.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Listen, this was
the best time you've ever had.
No.
Okay.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.